Welcome to Holden Village. In the fireside room, today's speaker is Richard Evans, and he will be doing one part of his Inquiring Mind series. So let's listen in on Richard.
It's my pleasure tonight to introduce to you Dr. Dick Evans, who is the chair of the Department of Music at Whitworth College, has a doctorate of musical arts from the University of Oregon, and will be speaking this evening on Johann Sebastian Bach, and we'll be exploring the question of how do we explain Bach's continued popularity even 250 years after his death. His music continues to be played and enjoyed by countless millions of people. And so we'd like to welcome Dr. Evans here. And this, by the way, I should say before we get started, is sponsored, part of the Inquiring Minds lecture series, which is sponsored by the Washington Commission on the Humanities. And so we'd like to thank the commission for making this all possible. Oh, and one more thing.
Go ahead.
I forgot all about this. Part of the Washington Commission's Humanities request of us is if you're so inclined, they would ask you to please fill out an evaluation of this performance. It's part of their ongoing pursuit of continuing to improve the lecture series, and just a part of their department. So I'll pass this around. Thank you.
A further PR announcement, if you like what the National Endowment for the Humanities does, be sure to write your congressman, because this program is supported from the national level. It's a very unique program that the State of Washington Commission has developed over the last 10 years. But after next year, there's a question whether this program will go on. I'd like to say also that we're delighted to be here, and I think I'm speaking to the converted as far as J.S. Bach is concerned. This is a series of lectures on the meaning of music and why music is important. We will have time for discussion afterward, and in fact, that's very important to the commission that we do that. So, it is not a kind of lecture where there's a lot of discussion during the lecture, but we'll certainly do a lot at the end, because I'm sure that you'll have things you want to say. Because I've already heard people singing Bach chorales around the village, so as I say, I'm preaching to the converted, I'm sure. So, we'll start right off with some evidence. Westminster Choir College in Princeton. There's a rich affinity existing between one of the great composers of all time and one of the most beautiful arias in the world. The composer lived at approximately the same latitude as this beautiful area, the Pacific Northwest. But at a time previous to any significant exploration in the Northwest. Many who have studied in what was once East Germany say that the similarities in climate and topography are very close to the western areas of the states of Oregon and Washington. But the similarity that we wish to discuss tonight is more than geographical. It is the appeal of this composer's music to the several million residents of our area. Why is it that a Bach festival exists in every corner of the Northwest, the Olympic Peninsula, Port Angeles, Lake Chelan, in 3 weeks there'll be one. Eugene, there's one probably just starting right now. Spokane every January, etc., etc., etc. Now it is not that he wrote a cantata extolling the virtues of coffee, something that is certainly the rage in the Northwest. I was back in Washington, D.C. recently and simply died because I couldn't find an espresso. There must be something about his music more than an obsession with caffeine. What is it about this timeless composer that inspires people to perform his music almost 250 years after his death? And why is it in the Pacific Northwest that two world-class musicians, Helmut Rehling of Germany and Gunther Schuller of the United States, come to lead festivals to honor the music of this man? One of the reasons for all this artistic activity is that J.S. Bach sits at the pinnacle of the most recently fully developed theoretical system in music. He sits at the peak of a development in music which we have used for over 300 years. And by the way, we are backing out of right now, searching for a new system. That may explain why some people think music is a little chaotic, but we're searching. But this system was the major-minor system, the major-minor scale system. Some people call it common practice. Some people call it the tonal system. Bach also sits at the threshold to Mozart, Beethoven, Haydn, looking back to the polyphony of Palestrina and De Lasso from the 16th centuries, and then looking straight up till today, which we will illustrate. Now, when I refer to polyphony, polyphony, many sounds, I mean music like we did last night and today at the Vespers, like a sophisticated round. There's music that is conceived horizontally. You compose one line that's a melody, you add another line to it. It is the combining of several musical lines, each existing in its own right. And as I said, the round would be a rudimentary example of such a style. Music from the 10th to the 18th centuries was mainly polyphonic. And Western European music is noted as one of the great efforts to develop music of many parts. Our students at Whitworth recently discovered, we discussed music of other cultures, of early cultures. And there are a lot of rhythm and a lot of melody and instruments, but not a great effort to develop music of many parts. Now, polyphonic music is contrasted to a melody supported by chords, which has been the emphasis since the late 18th century and up until today. So, polyphony, emphasis on the horizontal. We call it homophony, music that is one melody supported by chords. Now, Bach embodies the spirit of a millennium of music, not just a century. And we will discover this, I'm sure. The Yale historian Donald Grout, and I have to grin here, every music major in the last 60 years has grown up on the history of Western music by Donald Grout. Anyhow, we'll use Grout tonight because it is accessible. But anyhow, Grout mentions five characteristics of Bach which sets him apart. Number one, and most importantly for a group like this, a religious conception of the function of art and the artist. How we need to keep working on that in this century. Number two, a family tradition of craftsmanship. It wasn't the romantic idea of great imagination. You just worked it out when you composed. Number three, listen carefully, a tradition of assimilation from all sources by copying other people's scores. Now, how do students do this today? How do they assimilate music from the past? They listen to recordings. There weren't recordings back then. It wasn't always possible to play everything. And so there was a tradition of that you learned the music by copying it. Now, those of you who know that Bach copied from Vivaldi and others, I'm sure that was for that friendly little chuckle I heard. But of course, then also it wasn't so important to be original, merely to take the material and rework it at a higher and greater level, perhaps. Number four, assisting a system of patronage, whether by the church or the court. And then I think Grout just kind of puts it all together and says, pure genius. Now, the assimilation of all sources appeared soon. Bach became interested in the Italian style. And through the copying of Vivaldi's and Corelli's works, he began to develop the thematic conciseness and active rhythmic flow of the Italian Baroque. He also traveled to hear musicians from his own country, like the organist Buxtehude. And perhaps many of you know the story that there was a position to take over from Buxtehude, but you had to marry his daughter to get the organ position. And there weren't many takers, which probably says something about what she was like. But anyhow, just some of the little side notes here as we go along. But Bach went to hear other people's music, just like we go today to festivals to hear Bach's music and others. Now, the famous organist, Virgil Fox, how many of you know Virgil Fox? Okay, we'll have fun. All right. Virgil Fox said that Bach has experienced everything. And tonight we're going to see how he was a precursor of everything that has followed him in music. Now we will begin with the music of his time. It is said that he summarized the music that went before him. We have said that music was polyphonic. The fugue is the culmination of polyphonic music. It is a very sophisticated round. And one voice will come in, then the same melody will come in at another voice a little later, possibly at a fourth below or a fifth above. Third time, we'll get the original melody back, and the fourth time will be in the pedals in this particular example. I am going to use his little fugue in G. And this is an example of the culmination of music in which each part is like a melody. The height of polyphony. In, but I didn't know what to do with the first voice to keep it going. And that's where the art comes in. that the one voice keeps going and the other voices have to match. And that's one of the difficulties of writing polyphony. Now, if J.S. Bach has experienced everything, then he must show, in the words of Nietzsche, the Apollonian and the Dionysian traits. You say, what are those? The classic and the romantic spirits, which, according to Nietzsche, have dominated the past 2,500 years of European, Western European culture. Now, classic would be that which was associated with the head, to use those kind of terms. Romantic would be the heart. Classic would be left brain. Romantic, more right brain. In classicism, we emphasize form over personal content. But the story I always liked that if Mozart had a toothache when he was composing, he didn't know it because he was writing in a classical time. But with Gustav Mahler in the late Romantic, we know when he was having family traumas because some places the folk songs indicate the very event that he was writing about in his music. Now, using the trait of German craftsmanship, Bach constructs pure form in many of the works that he wrote. In the intermingling of French, Italian, and German ideas, he also shows form that is universal. It is an emphasis on that family trait of craftsmanship. Now, this little invention in F, I thought we'd spice things up a little bit and use a contemporary instrument, the synthesizer. Some of you know the argument, if Bach had had the piano, he would have used it, but he didn't, and away we go, you know, that argument. But notice how this short little canon fits together. Pure form, pure classicism. Aesthetics, we say, it's always been there. The opening of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, you know, it's just always been with us. But somebody had to create it. And that just seems so natural. Just, it falls so well. Now, it is probably quite doubtful that Bach in his day was visioning or thinking that he was doing music that would someday speak to all the subsequent eras that had followed his time. But genius explores all the realms of human endeavor, and Bach, in his tremendous output, being faithful to who he was, touched on many of the styles with which we are familiar. There are certain pieces, for instance, that demonstrate a rock beat, a straight bass beat, that began to hit in 1954 with rock and roll. And that's one of the things that young people like about Baroque music, is the fact that it has a straight bass beat. Music of his time also lent itself to improvisation. It's one of the things that's difficult for us to understand, that it's only with the Enlightenment that music was really tightly controlled, what we saw on the printed page. There's a lot of ornamentation that went on with each composer's work in the Baroque. And perhaps in the Renaissance, musica reservata, which most people really don't know what that means, but a kind of part of the performance in which the performers could do something, add something. So improvisation is not something that's just new because of jazz. 25 years ago, Ward Swingle took several of Bach's works and recast them as if they were written for jazz choir. As for jazz itself, its linear bass line, contrapuntal melodies, and free improvisation all suggest parallels to Bach's music, parallels that have been explored by such jazz performers as Dave Brubeck and the Modern Jazz Quartet. Apologize a little bit for the bass on this next cut. It was a little difficult to get the cut. I got it. I'll do everything I can to not offend your ears. Listen to the notes rather than the fidelity. As I said before, Bach was not the popular composer of his time that he is today. He was, in fact, ignored as a composer. And you all remember, I'm sure in this group you will remember, and I can ask this other audiences, and once in a while I'll get one hand or so, but you all remember Johann Gottlieb Graun or Johann Hasse? How many heard of those from the Baroque? Sure. And I know both of you are musicians and performers and would know that. But they were the well-known composers of the early 18th century. Oh, there was this organist born in 1685 in Eisenach who was known as a great performer on the pipe organ. But as a composer, Bach was not known. Now those of us who live in the Northwest, now those of you who don't live in the Northwest, you're going to have to understand our self-pity in this next statement here. But anyhow, those of us who live in the Northwest know what it's like to be ignored. Now, when the volcano blew up, 1980, we were having commencement at our college, and I rushed home. Nobody knew what was going on. We turned on the TV, and there's Walter Cronkite saying, Mount Lassen blew up, Northern California. By that night, he got it up into Oregon, and finally, the next day, they found out where the heck it was going on. But let some bomb go off in New York City and it, you know, it hits the world news right away. So, yeah, we of course know the advantages of living in the Northwest and we don't need all the publicity. I think we're getting it though, maybe a little too much. Bach was merely living out a faithful calling, creating masterpieces for the court and church. Fame was not the issue in his day. That it is today. There was a different zeitgeist, or a time spirit, a spirit of the time. Do a good job, and let history take care of it. One thing we really need right now is that one variable, longitudinal perspective. Remember that cartoon where Lucy comes up to Linus and Snoopy and they're dancing? She goes, shameful, shameful. And Linus says, 500 years from now, who will know the difference? On the reverse of that is, what will make a difference? You know, do a good job. And a lot of times I've seen people who are worried about their place in history get one, but it's not the one they expected. Sometimes it's negative. Now, Bach was concerned about human destiny, life and death issues. And it's in his religious music we find references to such themes. How many of you have been to Philadelphia at Wanamaker's department store? It's east side of City Hall. You walk in like this, seven stories, and on the south wall, there's a seven-foot pipe organ. Seven stories, I should say. They're bigger pipes than 7 feet, for sure. Well, Virgil Fox went in there one night and played and recorded some things, and I have a version for you of Come Sweet Death, and I think in itself, isn't that something? Come Sweet Death. Now, we know that Bach was reading Meister Eckhart, and they had a very strong religious point of view. But listen, if you will, to how the chorale is set by Fox, but also this idea of death, which we think is negative, but the word sweet, connected. Besides the fact that Bach was not well known as a composer, his sons were writing in the new style, and they told him he was old-fashioned. He was ignored. Isn't that awful to say you're old-fashioned? But Bach was resurrected by Felix Mendelssohn in 1829. That's more than 75 years after Bach's death. And from then on, he was treated with veneration and awe. To celebrate his discovering, his coming to life, as it were, as a composer, let us hear part of his Mass in B minor, where he celebrates the resurgence of life through the end, and Jesus rose again, the et resurrexit. We preface this example with a quote by composer Helmut Valka. Bach opens a vista to the universe. After experiencing him, people feel there is meaning to life after all.
Thank you.
I was a sophomore in college, Robert Shaw took that work on tour. And I remember how just stunned I was. It was 2.5 hours. And if you know Robert Shaw, he is like being on a team. He had to take a shower at the halftime, intermission we call it. But because he works so hard. And it was just glorious. And ever since then, this has been one of my favorite works. We'll hear a little bit more of it in a bit. The antithesis to a classic orientation is, as we've said before, the romantic. And of course, the music of the 19th century was essentially romantic. Last part of the 18th century was classic. Now, in the romantic tradition, we can do individual expression. If you have a toothache, well, your music may show it. And we're not so much concerned with the universal or form, but we're concerned with individual expression. Now, the music of Bach shares both the classic and the romantic spirits. Some say that the force of his music is the awesome power from the equilibrium between both sides, the classic and the romantic. You know, in the brain studies, when a trained musician listens, only the right brain lights up. But a trained musician, and of course that's the aha side where you're getting a deal of some kind of momentary impact, but a trained musician, both sides light up. And we want to say, do we want a great mind experience? Listen to music and be trained in the process, because it's a fully, your brain is fully active, more so than in other areas. Now, if Bach was good at writing a group of melodies in polyphonies, we certainly think that he could write one beautiful melody, which is often associated with romantic music. We think of the great melodies of Tchaikovsky and Brahms, Schubert. These are the things that we associate with music from the romantic period. And so let's listen to this well-known and beautiful melody. Section, one little lady says, couldn't you just let it play on? You know, I said, well, I'm supposed to talk, but I would be happy to let, I was happy to let Bach's music just go on. Well, now we're going out on a limb a little bit, but I think when we're done, it might make some sense. When I was in college, I remember playing a Bach chorale, and I found a major seventh right in the middle of it. Now, a major seventh may not mean a lot to some of you, but it was sort of in a place where you expect a jazz chord. You know, jazz chords are sort of, they have extensions. And I said, wow, isn't that early? Well, a colleague helped me find a fugue that I'm using for this next conjecture. Bach was a composer for the 20th century. The pianist Rosalind Turek, founder of the International Bach Society, says that the great fire for the study of Bach is the direct meaning that Bach has for us as contemporary persons. He is a phenomenon of our time. What attracts the young to Bach is what attracts them to any music, the beat. Glenn Gould says that there's a bridge between Bach's ideas of rhythm and those of the mid-20th century. His music throbs with a living pulse. His rhythms and harmonic modulations, however controlled, evolve with seeming spontaneity. Bach was not wrapped up in becoming a star. Rarely has an artist ever worked with less thought of teaching posterity. He said, "I was obliged to be industrious. Whoever is equally so may succeed." You know? A crystalline logic underlies all of Bach's work. In technique alone, he was probably the most accomplished composer in the history of music. His mastery of contrapuntal devices, those polyphonic passages, the fugue, spring from that rarefied realm where science and the aesthetic merge. Even Jean-Paul Sartre once wrote of Bach that he taught how to find originality within an established discipline. And those of you who teach creativity, we all know that we help our students when we limit them to a certain realm of discipline, and then they create in that realm. Now, in actual fact, Bach approaches our time when his music is chromatic. Now, you all know what the scales are. But when you play a chromatic, that's just seven of the 12 notes of the octave. A chromatic scale. And we learn how to play it on an instrument because it helps in some passages. But it's not the last system that we've used. Now, Bach has a fugue in which he comes close to what we call the 12-tone technique. This was a technique developed by the Austrian composer Arnold Schoenberg. And what you do is you play all 12 tones before you repeat any of them. And you set up a series of tones. It's a set. And you can put them in any order that you want. It's sort of democracy applied to the octave. All notes are created equal. Whereas in the major scale, five get left out. You know, the C scale on the white notes, you don't play anything on the black notes. And even when you use the black notes for major scale, you're still leaving five notes out. Okay. Now, this piece that I'm going to play for you, which I'll give you the title now, and it's on the harpsichord. This piece will show how Bach's use of traditional harmony teeters on the edge of beyondness, or as the jazz people say, beyond the groove, beyond the realm. He's knocking at the door of modernity within the opportunity of 17 chances. All 12 notes are used. Getting late. I didn't know we had another note in the octave here. And at one place, the harmony seems beyond any realm of the harmony being used. It's quite amazing. When my colleague in the keyboard department brought this example into me, I said, "Yes." It's like finding the missing link. Yes, we found it. So this will be a fun one, and possibly a surprise. Thank you. I know we've all been through the music of Wagner, Liszt, Chopin, all those composers who would use a lot of chromaticism, but this happened almost 100 years before their time. And harmonically, he's right on the edge of getting out there. And it's truly, truly amazing. There's another kind of contemporary style of music we call minimalism. How many of you have heard of minimalistic piece? We have a scholarship at Whitworth that will not be given to anybody who studies minimalism. That shows you some of the reaction. It's a pretty good scholarship, so I guess the person can delay their study until they graduate. But it's very new, and what it is, it's incessant repetition with subtle changes in the music. And really what it does is, in a sociological way, show you what a person does on the assembly line, day after day. Put the headlight in, hook it up. Put the headlight in, hook it up. Now I know they've changed that routine so it doesn't get monotonous, but minimalism reflects some of that monotony. And in this wonderful guitar prelude performed by Julian Bream, you're going to see some of that repetition. But it's very beautiful. It's very beautiful. But you'll notice that he doesn't change a thing for about every two measures. In the middle, every measure. But it has some form of the repetitiveness that we associate with minimalism. Some of his ability to use the technique to make it work. Now, I'm going to give the next one away right now so you can build up your expectations. I'm using the synthesizer because to illustrate a point that we have been mentioning along the way. Now, as we know, Bach wrote music lauding the joys of coffee and also music lauding the joys of pipe smoking. Now, using the idea of picture painting, Bach's rhythms often give us the lilt of those human movements associated with joy. Now, when we talk about picture painting, remember the Et Resurrected? The melody went up, bum, 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 bum. I mean, what he's doing with the notes is showing what Christ would have done to rise out of the grave. And sometimes in religious works, when he's talking about a snake, the biblical serpent, why the melodic line kind of winds its way around, you see. Now, one of these circumstances can be that which has to do with dancing, and a great dance meter is 6/8, where we go ta 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 ta. And you can just think of the joy of getting up here, or those of you who teach, the joy of the fact that school was over within the last month. We don't think about having to go back to civilization after this. But listen, if you will, also to a certain place where you hear on the synthesizer that rock beat that Glenn Gould was talking about, the beat out of world music.
Thank you.
Some of these might be clearness and acuteness of intellect, strength of will, high sense of duty, which are all religious qualities. And of course, now is the time for us to stand up and cheer. He was Lutheran in the German sense back then. Right here. Now, I think, as I said before, his B minor Mass really is one of the great religious works of all time. And that Agnus Dei, which we're going to listen to next, is practically my favorite piece of all time. It has a simple melody. It has a simple violin part. It has a continuo, which is a bass part with chords filled in. And when the soloist comes in, it has a poignant quality about the Lamb of God that takes away the sin of the world. And when a melody turns in upon itself, it goes up and then turns down, goes down and then turns back up. There's a certain kind of yearning in which we are asking, O Lamb of God, who takes away the sin of the world, have mercy upon us. And I think in this simplicity, there's something very great. The Agnus Dei, and yes, it is sung by a countertenor. This time that little lady was going to run me out of the room. Why don't you keep playing that? You know? Sometimes when we consider the Baroque, 1600 to 1750, the time in which Bach lived, we use the word storm to come up with descriptors. For instance, spaciousness, for the S, spaciousness. You know, before that time, there were hardly any orchestras. If there aren't any, there were groups of instrumentalists. And polyphonic music a cappella. But in the beginning of the Baroque, we began to put choruses and orchestras together to come up with the oratorio, and also opera, which leads to the theatrical nature of music, really developed in the 1600s. Oratorio, an unstaged religious opera, is essentially what it is. Ornamental, every composer had their own list of ornaments, and you think of some of the things about the Baroque that are very ornamental. R, storm for religious. There's when we have an equilibrium between secular and sacred. And then monumental. And I can't help but think of something that is monumental in the Baroque, as sort of the epitome of that, is the opening of the Mass in B minor, that Kyrie, which just comes like a wall of sound. How many of you have seen the movie Barry Lyndon? Barry Lyndon was about revolutionary times, and it had a pace like back then, rather than the way we do it. You know, we gotta leave at 1:45, catch the boat at 2:45, and we get there by 4:45, we get to Spokane by 9. Schedule, you know, we're just uptight. But that pace was slower. That pace was a lot slower. It's like when they had church for 5 hours. What else do they have to do? No NFL. No NFL to rush home to. No buses to catch. My wife will remember a time when we went to a big church in Portland. 11:55, the sermon wasn't over. The little lady got up. She had to go catch the bus. Got to get home. You know, it's time to get. So this is going to be a little longer stretch of Bach expressing Kyrie eleison, Lord have mercy on us. And a wonderful way to start in Mass, I might add. Articulations will be clear in a bit.